By this point in our course, it will come as no surprise that women had multiple paths to power in the medieval period. In some cases, that power was social and within the family, but in many others, certain women were able to gain significant religious and political power and authority. Our understanding of medieval women's power has changed dramatically over the past 20 years. Scholars used to emphasize that women's power was exceptional and confined to a few unique women, but more recent research has significantly challenged that idea. In this podcast episode, I speak with two scholars who have been doing that challenge, Dr. Amy Livingstone and Dr. Teresa Ehrenfeit. Today, we explore the multiplicity of power that women had access to with a focus on royal and noble women. Now, women's path to that power often came through their family connections, and we'll consider the variety of ways that women enacted it. But we'll also start by defining what we mean by power in the medieval period, and then consider how historians have reshaped their understanding of women's power in the past several decades. Dr. Amy Livingstone is the head of the School of History and Heritage and professor of history at the University of Lincoln in the United Kingdom. Her research focuses on the history of the aristocracy in 11th and 12th century France. She's published widely on the history of women in the aristocratic family. Her books include Out of Love for My Kin, Aristocratic Family Life in the Lands of the Loire, circa 1000 to 1200, and Medieval Lives, The World of the Beaugency Family, circa 1000 to 1292. In 2017, she was awarded the Medieval Academy Cara Award for excellence in teaching. And Dr. Livingstone is the co-editor of the newly relaunched journal Medieval People. Her current research project is writing the life of Countess Ermengarde of Brittany. Dr. Teresa Ehrenfeit is professor of history and program director for women, gender, and sexuality studies at Seattle University. Her research explores questions of women in power, authority, and agency, with a specific focus on queens and queenship. Her books include The King's Other Body, Maria of Castile and the Crown of Aragon, and the recent Catherine of Aragon, Infanta of Spain, Queen of England. She has also published a textbook on queenship in medieval Europe, as well as numerous edited collections.
Thank you so much, Amy and Teresa, for speaking with me today on the topic of women and power in the medieval period. I really appreciate your willingness to share your expertise on this topic.
Thank you for inviting us, Dana. This is great to be able to talk to you and to chat with your students.
It's absolutely delightful to be here and to have this opportunity to chat with your students, but also to chat with Teresa and you.
So we're going to start with some definitions, because when we introduce the topic of women in power, we don't always necessarily have an understanding of what we mean by power in the medieval period. So let's start with that question. And Amy, I'm going to go to you first. So what do we mean by power in the medieval period? And some subsidiary questions to that, what did access to power look like and how was power used?
It's funny because I was thinking of Teresa when you asked this question, because, and I'm going to try to paraphrase this, but... In the sense that, you know, power is having the authority to tell people to do things. It's having that ability. And I think that is a nice catch-all for medieval women. And most of my remarks today will be focused on elite women, since I work on the aristocratic women of medieval France. So I wanted to have that caveat. I think it works well in a variety of contexts. It works well for queens. It works well for aristocratic women. It works well for urban women. It works well for peasant women as well. I also think that basically having the ability to tell people to do things is one way of having power. I also think the ability to influence events around you is also another way of demonstrating power. And for me, when I think of power in the Middle Ages, I think of it as a spectrum, right? There are different colors of power, different, sort of the Baskin-Robbins 31 flavors of power that different people exercise and different women exercise. And even the same woman exercising different kinds of power in different settings. So to give an example, the countess that I work on certainly has the ability to command and to tell people to do things, but she also has the power to intervene. So that's a very different kind of power than saying, you will go do what I tell you to do, as opposed to I'm going to use my powers of persuasion and my influence and my status to have you do something that I would like you to do.
Mm-hmm. Teresa, I'm going to ask you to add to that because you are one of the leading scholars in thinking about this particular question.
Thank you for thinking of me as a leading scholar, because when I first started thinking about power, I was taking my dissertation and turning it into a book, and I realized that I really didn't know what those terms meant. Mm-hmm. And I remembered conversations in grad school with Joseph O'Callaghan, my dissertation advisor, and he said, there's a difference between power and influence and power and authority. Mm-hmm. And I began to dive into that. And I realized that all of the people talking about power were talking about men. Yes. And men having a very static form of power at a particular point in their life. Because power, you could expand it over a life cycle. Mm-hmm. You have different kinds of powers when you're young, different when you're older. And then between power and authority. So authority is the legal right, the licit approval to be able to exercise power, to influence, to command, to persuade. And then there's, so power is the doing of it, but influence is the licit backup for it. But then there's this wonderful, very nuanced word called agent, which I find really useful because it nuances the notion of power and it makes it more autonomous. Here's how I describe this to students. The power is like when you're a child and your parents are telling you what to do. So your mother says, you're having Cheerios for breakfast. And that's power, right? She has that authority because she's your mother, but you have the agency to go, no, mom, I want Trix. Agency is more autonomy rather than I'm not telling you what to do. I'm telling me what I want. And I think the other part of power is the ability to say no, the power of saying no, because I learned that when I was working on Maria of Castile, because there's a point in her queenship late in her career where her husband is just doing some really stupid things regarding the peasants. And she's fed up. And she basically says, Alfonso, I'm gone. I'm out of here. I am not going to do this anymore. And I thought, whoa, that's power. She walked away.
I like your point about agency, Teresa, because I think it centers on the individual, right? And having the ability to act, right? Mm-hmm. To say no, or in my countess's case, Ermengarde, the ability to say, I'm going to go join this convent now. And then 3 years later, have the ability to say, guess what? I'm not going to be a nun anymore. I'm going back to being a countess. That's another facet of that agency we see with women. I also think that when we think about political culture and thinking about the scholarship over the last decade or so, the conversation really has shifted. As Teresa points out, conversations about power when we were starting out as early career scholars was about men being king, right? Mm-hmm. Very static, very precise exercise of power at a particular point in your life. And now we talk about political culture. And I think that's been a really important shift for studying women, but also other kinds of men, right? Ministers, bishops, brothers, nephews, fathers, uncles, in terms of the influence that they have. So the idea that one person ruled absolutely by themselves without having this political culture around them is something that we've really moved away from, and understanding that it's far more than it is singular or individual. And that works equally well for women. The women that we study certainly had advisors and friends and mothers and nieces and children that advised them and helped them to execute whatever idea that might have, or they wanted to command something or raise an army or build a cathedral or whatever it might have
been. Well, I think what that does is it takes feminist theory and it applies it to power. Because when I first started looking at power, I was struck by how masculinized it was. There were notions of vertical power. Everything had to come top down or bottom up. But what you just described, Amy, is a horizontal. It's a kind of a community-based power rather than from God or from peasants. Political theorists used to also talk about hard and soft power, which is such a masculinist way of looking at it. Like hard power is popes and kings and armies. Mm-hmm. And soft power is like diplomacy. And they would say it with this tone of voice, oh, it's soft power. And I'm like, what? It is power.
Exactly.
And so there was this denigration of power that didn't have a sword attached to it as somehow lesser, but I don't know. It's just as powerful.
Absolutely.
I think that's a really important point, right? That the way we think about power is much more diffuse in terms of the types of people that can access to it, but also the way that it's wielded. It's not just wielded by individuals, that these people are often working together, achieve similar aims, or they're not, in which case they're fighting over who has the right to gain that power.
And they used to talk about queens as having pillow talk power, which drove me incredibly angry. I thought, pillow talk power? Which is really basically just horizontal. Well, that's terrible to say, this horizontal power as a line of bed. But it is, it
also takes be vertical power depending on.
I never thought of it that way before, but I was so angered by that because I thought, wow, that is such a diminishment of someone's power. A queen's power and a noblewoman's as well comes from her family, from her wealth, from her education, from her experience. Mm-hmm. And that is not exerted solely on a pillow.
I agree entirely. And it just objectifies women and turns them into sexual yes. objects. And the only way yeah. they have power is through their body and through their sexuality, which is right. something that we've obviously been pushing back against for a long time. And the other one that drives me bonkers is formal versus informal power. The ability to influence what gets done where and to muster the resources to found a nunnery or go to the Holy Land a crusade or whatever it might be, that's not soft. That's not right. informal. It was very much this, well, because it's a woman, it can't be the same kind of power mm-hmm. as a man. And of course, he who shall not be named, otherwise now for your students, I will name him. A French scholar by the name of Georges Duby wrote this horrific article about potestas and how you had to have a sword. And potestas basically translates into power in Latin, that you had to have a sword in order to have potestas. And because women didn't have a sword, they couldn't have power. Over the last, however many long years, we have come to really nuance and understand just how complex power can yeah. be. You can't just say power anymore and have this sort of singular definition. You have to think about who it is, when it is, where it is, and their life stage. I think that was an important point you made, Teresa. Mm-hmm. that your power changes over the course of your life, male or female, doesn't yeah. matter.
Yeah. Well, to go back to the hard, soft, horizontal, vertical again, I keep thinking back, no one would ever say about Cardinal Richelieu, oh, he just had soft power, or advisors to kings. And it gets back to questions of the word favorite, because I remember studying people at court, and favorite was a sly word to say, oh, they must be having a sexual relationship, or there's something devious going on here. So it's always seen as underhanded power rather than direct power. This is mm-hmm. not soft power.
We've already talked a little bit about this question of the gendering of power, which I think our discussion about how the ideas around this has changed is really important. And we've spent a lot of time in this course thinking about the distinctions between theory and practice, which we do regardless of what we're teaching in history, but I think for women's and gender history is especially important. Mm-hmm. What was the difference between theory and practice in terms of thinking about gender and power in the medieval period?
I will say when I started my work as a graduate student and then as an early career scholar, the theory or the paradigm that was dominant was created by Georges Duby. Mm-hmm. And it was all about how women had no power. Women were strictly subordinate. He labeled the medieval period the male Middle Ages. So there was a very strong theory in place when I started doing the work. And a whole generation of us have spent our lives in the archives reading the documents and thinking, I don't know what documents he was reading, because we see women everywhere here. His whole yeah. configuration of aristocratic family life, which was primogeniture, so only firstborn sons were important, patriarchal, men controlled everything, impartible inheritance, so nobody got a share of the family wealth except for the eldest born son. Taking that model and going into the archives and re-examining it, and I'll be frank here, from an American feminist perspective, revealed a whole different world than the one that he was describing. And in fact, one of my favorite lines from Monsieur Duby is that I read the documents of the Middle Ages, I hear only men convinced of their superiority. And those of us working in the documents that he studied say he must have been in the archives with his fingers in his ears, because literally we can hear the women screaming from the sources that they're there. So that was what I continue to work against, is this model of repression, patriarchy, that it was the male Middle Ages, that somehow women were silent and unimportant. So for me, that whole vision of aristocratic life is something that greatly influenced what I was interested in and shaped my scholarship to some degree, because I was arguing directly against that, because what I found wasn't that. And you can multiply yeah. my experience across at least a dozen French medieval mm-hmm. historians who very similarly went into the archives and said, but no, we don't see at all.
I think that talking about Duby, that really is a great case for how someone's selective reading of sources and with a great deal of influence creates a theory. So he actually took a handful of documents and created a normative theory, mm-hmm. but that had no relationship to what was actually going on. That I think theory is best when it's explanatory, rather than saying, mm-hmm. this is the way the world works. Say, yeah. this is what I see, and here's how I understand it. Because that to me is evidence-based theory rather than pie in the sky, my mm-hmm. own prejudices kind of theory. Because mm-hmm. Duby really did scar a lot of people. And still does. Your work has so taken him apart. And I remember I used one of your articles and you sent an email to me about it saying how you were terrified that with your first article that took down George Duby. And my students loved that. They said she was afraid. And I said, who wouldn't be? This was George Duby. Yeah. And that made you come alive to them. And the whole interaction of evidence and theory and explanatory and interpretive pieces, mm-hmm. all of a sudden they got it.
Well, thank you, Teresa. That's very kind of you to say. And when my book came out, the Out of Love for My Kin, I got an email from Martin Aurel, who's a very prominent French medievalist and a terrific scholar. And he wrote and he said, dear Amy, just want to let you know that I've reviewed your book and I liked it overall, but I felt at the end of this all, I realized I had to stick up for my mentor, George Duby. And so he kindly sent me a copy of his review. And it took me about a week before I could open it because I was absolutely terrified because I thought, it was nice having a career and you'll never get into another French archive. And I read the article and there were two lines at the end that basically said, while Livingstone argues against Duby and his model, there's still some value in what I can live with that because I had expected to be taken apart because he was Duby's student and Duby's chateau has been incredibly long. In France. He's been dead since, 1994? And yet his scholarship, everybody runs it up the flagpole, is what you think about women in the Middle Ages. And I think in your work, Teresa, one of the things I like best about it is that you really skilled at using theory and explaining it and contextualizing it in a way that I obviously... medieval scholar, so I can follow the argument that students can understand and that a general audience can understand.
Thank you for that. I have to credit a colleague of mine who's a philosopher, who when I was first struggling with this, I'm like, how do I understand this? She goes, all you need are 4 pages from Foucault, History of Sexuality, 4 pages, 98 to 102. And I'm like, seriously? She goes, yes, that is all you need to get started. And ever since then, it all made sense. So it was my conversations with somebody who's so skilled in Foucault that just opened it all up. That's the perfect, to me, idea of interdisciplinarity. Mm-hmm. When I could just knock on Leisha's door and go, I have no idea what this means. I had never heard of the phrase biopower before. And she just opened that up for me, this notion that the state has control of your body. And it has so much meaning for us now, but it is a form of power that Foucault talks about greatly.
And I think that's why these conversations among scholars, not only within our own disciplines, but outside of our disciplines are so important. And students don't get to hear them very often, right? Because those are conversations that we have at conferences or that we have in our departments or at our institutions, and they're not necessarily in the classroom. But that's how we work as scholars. We grow and develop and our work gets better because we have those conversations. And I try to tell students, have conversations about your work with me and with each other. That's how you get to be a better scholar. Mm-hmm. So let's think about more specific examples of how we understand these ideas of gender and power in the Middle Ages. So are there particular distinctions we should highlight in terms of how people of different genders accessed power? Mm-hmm. And how have historians explored this question? And I think we've talked about this already, right? The legacy of Duby, but how have some other scholars thought about it? And Teresa, I'll start with you this time.
We're thinking about going down the social hierarchy. Scale, someone like Judith Bennett really works well for me in terms of understanding the family dynamics in terms of power. I'm looking at Cecilia Pennefather's family, and here's this woman who is a single peasant woman who theoretically should have had no power whatsoever. And yet she held land, could exchange land, could bequeath things theoretically to her heirs. I think her power came from her family. And so I'm really interested in family-based power. And that's part of why queenship was such an interesting thing for me to work with, because that's exactly what it is. And Amy used the word corporate power. It really is. It's this body of people that have shared interests, and that one person among that group, either because of age or because of expertise or because of wealth or whatever it is, has the ability to exercise more power. To me, that's what the royal family is. Mm-hmm. Ideally, it shouldn't just be primogeniture, eldest son. It should be whomever is the most qualified. And that doesn't always work that way. But I think that's why those notions of family power, but then there's also patriarchal power, which pushes up against that when push comes to shove, men are preferred over women. And a woman has to really push hard and work hard. So like Isabel of Castile was not destined to be queen at all. She was destined to marry a king, but not necessarily be a queen. And then circumstances pushed her forward. And Amy, do you find something similar with your noble families?
Thinking about aristocratic women, clearly family is important. And in terms of what the family controls, provides opportunities for women. I don't think there's any question about that. And clearly the other thing too, is that getting back to the idea of corporate, for a long time, we just assumed that wives were just wives, right? They took care of feeding people and looking after the household, that kind of thing, the sort of informal squishy power. And really what we've come to understand is that it's corporate in the sense that you have account and accountess, and each of them have power. And again, when we look, for example, the one that I study, Ermengarde of Brittany, she was the Countess of Brittany she lived between 1070 and 1147. She was Countess of Brittany between 1093 and 1147. And she is called Domina, and Domina is the feminine of Dominus, meaning Lord. So clearly she has those sorts of powers, those sorts of responsibilities. But there's another component to this, and I think it has to do with gender space. And I think women in particular, because of their gender, have a space where they can operate that men may not be able to. And at least this is true for Ermengarde, which is her relationship with the church and her very conscious construction of a network of ecclesiastics around her that she could call on and that could call on her. So it's very much a sort of symbiotic relationship between these men and the countess. So family is important. It sets women up in important ways and gives them access to things that they wouldn't necessarily have depending on, you know, where they fall in the hierarchy. But I also think there's something else in addition to family that allows women to have latitude and access to different sorts of power and influence that their husbands couldn't have, for example. It's pretty clear that Ermengarde has got friends in high places that her son does not, and she rules with her son for the last 30 years of her life, or her husband. And that's unique to her.
You bring up a really important point, because I think what we need is more work on gender spaces. Because I'm thinking about now is the idea of warfare, that the one area where it seems, but I don't think this is true necessarily, but the evidence to date has shown that women do not exercise a lot of power through warfare. But I want more research on that, because I'm not buying it. I think there were ways that women exerted a lot of official authority through warfare, because they had to. They're protecting their homes, especially during periods when men are at war doing other things. Because I think the key thing that comes out of this is that gender power is a dynamic. It's not just held in one person. It goes back and forth. And so those dynamic relationships of how power and authority and agency are moderated and exerted really are much more than just top down or bottom up, right? It's that exchange of it. And I think that's where gender spaces come in, because I think women do have places where they are more likely to exert power. And I think Duby did not look there. He was looking in the conventional spaces where, and that's not where you're going to find all forms of power.
Absolutely. And the art historians and the historians of space have done a wonderful job of pushing back about the idea that somehow women were excluded from spaces like monastic spaces. They couldn't go into the monk's charter house. Okay. The document is issued in the monk's charter house and her signature is there. Come on, let's get real here. Clearly she is there. So you're right. These spaces and analysis of space is really interesting in terms of the spaces that people inhabit and what that tells us about them and their particular context, but also the influence that they can exercise.
And I think we also need to think about the way that just because someone loses an argument or a whatever, doesn't mean that they're powerless. It means they're overpowered. And I learned this working on Catherine of Aragon. She was never powerless. She was overpowered. Because up to her death, she still was one of the toughest people you'll ever encounter. And she had a lot of power and influence, but Henry had more. So we have to bear that in mind and not say, oh, it was powerless. I'm phrasing it as she was merely overpowered or overshadowed. I think that's what a lot of what's happening with our understanding of women is, they're overshadowed by these big, important male figures, but they're there and they're not powerless. They are merely obscured.
I think that's absolutely right, that they are obscured, that they're overpowered. And in addition to these new sources that hopefully we can find evidence of women at war, fresh eyes. I looked at the same documents as George Duby. And they were the same ones where he saw nothing, no women doing anything. I saw agency and influence and activity and all these sorts of things. And I think that's really important, is reinterrogation of our sources, looking at the old stuff with fresh eyes And a lot of our colleagues in France have done this. And I think of Linda Mitchell's work in England and looking at the law and looking at court cases and finding women doing all sorts of extraordinary, particularly the Marshall women, doing all sorts of extraordinary things. And she just uncovered a cache of seals at Magdalen College in Oxford. They're just amazing. I mean, they're middle-class women, which we tend think of as having those sorts of symbols of their power or agency. So fresh eyes on old sources. And then, as you say, Dana, looking for new stuff. And your work with Alex, oh my goodness, being able to dig into those thousands of documents, and because of the teamwork element to it, able to come up with putting the flesh on very bare bones, which wouldn't have happened, you know, anybody else but the two of you.
And it's interesting to think about taking down old. So there's Jaume Mariera is a longstanding historian of Jews in medieval Catalonia. And his work is wonderful, right? We couldn't actually do what we do without the stuff that he has done. But we have women who come up again and again. And like, we have hundreds of documents related to these women, and he doesn't mention them once in his book.
Wow.
And these women are married to really wealthy men, they're widows. Like, these are incredibly wealthy women. They have major connections in the Jewish community, and he never mentions them at all. And we miss a huge part of the story of this community. Yeah.
And I think what that points to is the necessity of checking our a priori assumptions and getting rid of them. Because when I first started working on Maria of Castile, I remember thinking, wait, because she had a tremendous amount of power and authority. For 28 years, she basically ruled Barcelona while Alfonso was off in Naples conquering and then living there for the rest of his life. And my first thought was like, whoa, nobody complained. I had this assumption that a woman in power would generate complaints. I went again to talk to Joe O'Callaghan and I said, is she the exception that proved the rule? And he said, you're assuming there's a rule. The minute I checked my assumptions at the door, I could read the documents in a whole new way. And that was crucial.
That's another important thing for students to understand too, is that archives are shaped in particular ways by archivists, and that can hide women's activities.
Exactly. And, you know, all of the stuff that I look at in the archives, I don't look for Ermengarde, because if you go to Ermengarde, she's not there. But if you look for her father, if you look for her husband, if you look for her son, you'll find those documents. So,
yeah, we have to change a lot of archival practices, because when I was working on the book on Catherine of Aragon, I would go to the British Library and everything's cataloged under Henry. All of these books that are apparently owned by Henry VIII, including Dante in Castilian. And I'm thinking, not on your life did Henry read that book. And so part of what I'm going to do this summer is I'm going back to the British Library and I'm going to sit with them and go, we need to talk about your cataloging practices, because his books are not her books. She has a tremendous library that's not there. And it's just that sense of it's buried under that. So you go to the Victoria and Albert Museum, it's the same thing. Everything's cataloged under Henry. But I swear to you, Henry did not own napkins with castles and lions on them. That is not a Henry object.
No.
It's really insidious how it's so shaped by 19th century men who were trying to do a good job of archiving, but they also did a disservice.
You hear the people who work on the editions of the rolls in England, because the 19th century editors basically, and this happened with the 19th century editions of some cartularies too. They just took the woman out because they didn't think they were interesting. That whole paragraph about the woman, they just leave it out, and you go to the archive and you're like, why isn't this in the cartulary of Marmoutier? Because the person decided it wasn't important.
But that's what you've done, Amy, that's so valuable, because you've had us read the whole thing, not just a calendared extract.
Yeah.
That is absolutely vital.
When people ask me, why do you think Duby had such a different perspective? I'm like, I'm not sure he read beyond the first or second line of the charter. Not to disparage him, because he was brilliant and he was fabulous, but I look at my view and others. It's not just me. A whole generation of us, lots of us have looked at these documents and went, huh? I don't know how you get that interpretation.
So the archivists have power, right? Back to the power question.
Yeah.
It's up to us to challenge that. And even if they don't recatalog stuff, because I know that is a massive bureaucratic headache, but at least to note that what they've done is obscured things. The other thing is that it highlights the importance of actually being on the ground in an archive and being able to go through stuff over and over again.
Yeah.
And that is so important. And I hope one of the things that thinking of the power of the purse now, that we need more grants, more fellowships to get more people to sit in archives and go through piece by piece, what's there, what's missing, how do I find what I need, or how do I interpret what's here?
And publishers too, because a new edition of the Acts of the Counts of Brittany came out Acts of the Counts of Brittany.
Ah, something's missing here.
And God bless, it's a wonderful, it's sitting right here on my desk. I use it every single day. It's a wonderful tool. Getting back to your point, Teresa, about Catherine's books, everything is from the male perspective. It's not the Counts and Countesses of Brittany, even though, boy, the Countesses of Brittany, Ermengarde among them, were powerful and influential. But it's just the assumption, right, that it's the Counts that are important, and that's what's cataloged, and that's what we need to have. So one of the things I hope to do with the Ermengarde project is to create an appendix to the book, a list like what Kim Lepret did for Adèle Blois, right. Looking through, and instead of the acts, the Counts of Blois-Chartres, but looking at Della's acts, and they are just hers. Now, obviously her husband and her son are in them, but she's the focal point. And I think we need to flip that or start to get people to think about being more inclusive.
But we're writing, if we don't do that, we're writing an incomplete history. And we can't do that. We are historians. We should be as complete as we possibly can.
So Alex and I's part of our investigation into these Jewish women started because we knew they were there, but we didn't really know much. When we were in Girona, our very first trip in Girona, we found this tiny little book in the Jewish Museum bookshop called Na Blanca. And it was about this woman named Blanca who lived in Girona, and Sylvia Planas, who was the only person who had written anything about a Jewish woman in Girona, had pulled together her story and had written for tourists this little book about this woman, Blanca, and her experience. And she's a pretty exceptional woman, right? Her father was the royal astronomer, and, you know, so she's very wealthy. But she has this story where she converts in the violence, and then her husband dies, and there's all these kind of things that happen, and she eventually goes back to living as a Jew in Portugal. But she had a list at the end of notarial records related to Blanca.
Oh, wow.
And so we started with that. Let's go find Blanca. And we were like, okay, we have a place to look. And then, of course, they were just everywhere. But I think those types of things can be so valuable for us as scholars because they make us realize it's there. So here's a place to start. And then we can go on our hunt and see what else we can find as we go along.
It is that inspiration comes in interesting ways, doesn't
it?
It really does. You can't just assume that it's in the archives, little table of contents or however they organize stuff.
Yeah.
That it can come in very unexpected ways.
So I wanted to actually turn to this question of political power, because both of you have worked on women who have access and have wielded political power in different ways as nobles and as royal women. So what are the different types of political power that women wielded in the Middle Ages? How did they get access to those roles? Where did they come from? But also, did they face any resistance in doing so, or were those positions accepted?
I can start with queens, and I speak Iberian queens in particular because I know them best, but also because I think they're such an interesting test case, because the range of possibilities in Iberia was so different than France or England or the German realms or in Italy. And we're all trying to figure out why that is. I think it has to do with this all hands on deck, the necessity of all people to pull together stuff. I don't know that Spaniards are so much more open-minded, but I think they're more pragmatic about it and less driven by theory. Because queens and royal women in Spain, in the Iberian realms, could muster armies, could lead battle, could enact laws, could deal with popes and bishops, just like a king could. There was almost nothing they couldn't do until it got a little, and I don't know if it's the influence from the continent or what happens around the middle of the 12th century, where it starts to shift. It could be the number of baby girls born to queens as opposed to baby boys, because a lot of queens in the early, like in the 12th century, gained their power because their brothers were, they were either no brothers or they died young. So there's questions of things like, where are you in birth order? How many siblings do you have? But it's royal women. What is happening with warfare? Do you need to be on guard all the time? So those kinds of things nuance it. But there's something really fascinating about the range and depth of the kind of power that the Iberian queens could have. And that, I don't know that that's not exceptional in Spain, but I think it is different than it is in England and France.
I think it is different, but I also wonder if it's different because the Iberian Peninsula is so much more richly endowed with sources on queenship than in any other part of Western Europe, pretty much. I don't know if it's that they were unusual or that Spain was different or that we just don't know that when we're doing these things in other places. Because we do get hints. We get the odd nugget of information that leads us to interesting questions and makes us wonder, maybe there's something going on here or more than what appears from the documents that we have. In terms of political power and aristocratic women in France, I would say that their power, it really depends on the individual. I think that one of the fun things about doing history is telling the stories of individual people and their experiences. So for example, the woman that I'm studying, and I know you're all tired of hearing about Ermengarde.
Well, I'm going to ask you more questions about her later. So.
Never.
My children refer to it as being Ermengarded when I start talking about her. But thinking about Ermengarde, her fingers were in every pie. She was very powerful in the county as countess with her husband and then with her son. So her husband, Alan, becomes a monk in 1112, and her son is actually not that young. He's probably in his late teens, but mom and dad don't think he's quite ready to be count on his own. So they're set up sort of joint rulers. And that remains the case until she dies in 1147 and her son Conan dies 6 months later. So she is absolutely a presence in the political realm of Brittany and consulted in charters, asked by the papal legate to intervene on the behalf of the church. She's really involved in just about everything that's going on. So that's her as countess. And then we have Conan's wife, Matilda, who was the illegitimate daughter of King Henry I of England. So she's got a pretty, spiffy background there. She's the daughter of a king, granted, illegitimate or natural child of a king, but still, she comes from a high, probably a fairly highly aristocratic family. So this is somebody who should probably be like Ermengarde and be involved in politics, but she is barely present in the documents. I think she might appear in three charters and you don't have any sense of her at all. And was that because she had the mother-in-law from hell? I don't know. Maybe Ermengarde took up all the air in the room and there wasn't room for Matilda. Or was it her personality? Maybe she didn't want these sorts of things and was perfectly content remaining in the background or doing other things that may have gone unreported. So I think personality and context is important for understanding why and how women have different kinds and different levels of political power. And getting back to your question about, was this met with resistance? And Teresa's point of, well, we expected people were going to complain because the queen was there, but they didn't. And an example from Brittany is Ermengarde's son, Conan, decides to make his daughter, Bertha, heir to the county of Brittany and not his son, Hoel. And what's really fascinating is that early modern and modern scholars had to come up with a reason why this happened. And this is completely fictionalized. But the early modern historians of Brittany had decided that the reason why I decided to go with Bertha and to disinherit his son, which he actually didn't because he became the Count of Nantes, one of the big regions within Brittany. So he wasn't pushed aside or disinherited, but his daughter and her line are the ones that are chosen to become the next counts of Brittany. So what they decided was, is that Conan suspected that his wife Matilda was unfaithful to him. And therefore he wasn't sure that Hoel was his son. So he had to disinherit him and go with his daughter. For whatever reason, he was sure, I don't know why, that Bertha was from his line. And there's none of this, none in the medieval sources. At all, whatsoever. Wow. It's all the imaginations of, frankly, 16th century ecclesiastics who are writing the history of Brittany, and they have to come up with a reason. And it has to, of course, it has to be a slut to explain why the daughter was preferred over the son. But when you look back through the history of inheritance in Brittany, and even forward, daughters inherit equally with sons. And there are countesses who were preferred over sons. There are countesses who get part of the county. It's just part of a larger inheritance pattern. Was there resistance in the medieval period? No. But the early modern scholars just couldn't stand for the idea that somehow a woman would be preferred over a man in terms of being the next ruling family of Brittany.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of erasure is so troubling. And what it does is it says that but the best work on power needs to set men and women side by side and look at the long haul of their lives together, if they're countesses, kings, whatever they are, and say, how does the balance, how does the power, how do the power dynamics shift and move over time? And where does the opposition come from? Mm-hmm. Is it from later scholars who can't admit that this might have happened, or is it happening on the ground? Mm-hmm. That I think will be more revealing, because it'll get us, we never ask this question of kings, oh, was he disempowered? Was he a slut? We only ask that of women. But when you put them side by side and you look at the circumstances of their life, there may be a lot more revealed about how power actually operates, rather than just some sort of prejudice that by some 16th century scholar who didn't want to have women be included in the story.
So Amy, I'm going to ask you to Ermengarde us more then. So your research has focused on the life of Countess Ermengarde of Brittany. Can you talk about your work that you're doing on her, but also in particular, I'd love to hear more about the type of sources and the methodology that you use. I mean, you've talked about this a little bit, but can you explore it in more detail?
Sure. So let me just give you the soundbite of Ermengarde's life for your students so they can have a little context. So Ermengarde is born about 1070. Her father is the Count of Anjou. Her mother is the Countess. And her mother dies by the time she's seven. So Ermengarde is raised at her father's court and She was educated at the nunnery in Angers. Highly educated woman, could read Latin, educated by some pretty impressive nuns who were part of a larger intellectual and cultural community of the Loire Valley in the late 11th century. In 1093, she marries Count Alan IV of Brittany, who is probably 15 to 20 years older than she is. And she becomes the Countess of Brittany and moves to Brittany. Now, Brittany and Anjou are contiguous counties. They share a border. So she didn't go all that far, at least from, you know, our perspective. But in the medieval world, Brittany was seen as very different and very much sort of an outlier to medieval France. So she moves to Brittany, becomes Countess. Her husband, Alan, goes on crusade in 1096, leaves her in charge of the county. He returns in 1101. When he left, they had two children. So she bears two children between 1093 and 1096, and she's pregnant with a third when he leaves. So she bears two sons and a daughter, and he returns in 1101. By the time he gets back, Ermengarde undergoes some sort of religious moment, and there are a lot of motivations for this, but she decides she's going to become a nun at the recently founded Abbey of Fontevraud, just down the road from Angers. And she's a nun there for about 3 years. When she decides to go back to being a countess, and I argue in my soon to be hopefully published book in the next few years, that she does this because she's called back and it's necessary for her to return to the political situation in Brittany and Angers. She remains in Brittany as countess. She returns as countess pretty seamlessly, rules with her husband until his retirement in 1112, and her son and she take over. She remains in Brittany till about 1129, 1130, when she decides to become a nun once again. And she becomes a nun, this time as a Cistercian nun, and is veiled by St. Bernard Clairvaux himself. Wow. She leaves that order after about 18 months and decides to travel to the Holy Land to visit her half-brother, who happens to be the King of Jerusalem. And she's there for about 4 years. She founds a church while she's there, and she's back in Brittany by about 1135, where she remains until her death in 1147. Throughout the course of her life as countess, she is involved in just about every political dimension of the county. She is called upon by very powerful men to intervene on their behalf with her son and to restore her son, who gets into all sorts of trouble with the church, to the church's good graces, and to reform the church in Brittany, which is seen as corrupt and problematic. So she's got some very powerful friends and a very conscious network of powerful ecclesiastical men who were her close friends and advisors. So that's Ermengarde. What are the challenges of writing the life of a medieval countess? I wasn't even sure I could write her life, because sometimes you don't have a nice array of sources that you can use. The backbone to my study is not going to come as a surprise to either Dana or Teresa, are going to be this wonderful genre of sources called charters. And what these are, documents that record the transfer of property, usually between an aristocrat and the church, or between two ecclesiastical communities. And while you're all thinking, oh boy, sales documents, that sounds exciting, they're not what we think of in terms of land deeds today. These are not They're a little bit formulaic. They have the same sort of content, but they're very chatty and they provide all sorts of lovely little details about stuff. So I'm using those as the backbone of my study and then supplementing that with information about her from histories written at the time, looking at literature in terms of what we can delve into about women in the time from literature, the material culture, looking at the objects that she would have known, the spaces that she would have inhabited. And I only have, sadly, one source, one letter in Ermengarde's voice. So I'm writing her life with only one source in her voice. And it's actually a copy of a letter that she wrote. So it's not even in her hand, but that's the challenge. And as I know your students know, the big challenge to doing medieval women's history are finding the sources and finding the sources you can use to construct a life. And I've been using a sort of very omnivorous approach and just anything that I can use to try to fill in a gap. And one of the things that I have discovered is just how important it is to literally walk in their shoes and go to the places and go to the buildings and go to the churches so you can see where they live, what they experienced. And in addition to the church in the Holy Land, just outside of Nablus today, that Ermengarde founded, she also founded a church, just a whole community of Fontevraudian nuns just north of Rennes at a place called Saint-Sulpice-la-Forêt. And one of the things I discovered was going to Saint-Sulpice-la-Forêt and then visiting Robert of Arbrissel's church at La Roye shows this very strong architectural connection between what Ermengarde is doing in Brittany and what we see in Anjou. So again, trying to be as omnivorous as possible. The last thing I'll say is I'm still struggling with how I'm going to write her life. Now, Teresa has written this absolutely brilliant book about Catherine, but basically she started with an object and decided to write her life through objects. And a traditional biography is one way of doing it, starting with young Ermengarde, then going through to dead Ermengarde. But I'm not in love with that idea, and I'm still trying to figure out a way to tell her story that's a little more interesting, a little more dynamic than start to finish. So right now, and this may change, is I'm organizing the book around events that I see as being most important to Ermengarde, right? The moments in her life that seem most important. Now, it may be roughly chronological, but there may also, I haven't decided if it's gonna be chronological or thematic. So I'm still playing with how I'm going to deliver her life. But that's Ermengarde. She's great fun. One of the questions you asked us to talk about was how do you find your topics, encouraging students to do research. I found Ermengarde of Brittany from her mother. When I was working on my book on the Beaugency family, Medieval Lives, I was looking for Ermengarde of Beaugency, who married Count Fulk IV of Anjou. So what did I do? I Googled her. And everything that came up with Ermengarde of Beaugency was actually Ermengarde of Anjou or Brittany. And it was my Ermengarde. And I read the little description. I thought, wow, this is cool. She's great. I bet there's all sorts of stuff on her. So I went out to try to find books and articles on Ermengarde of Brittany and was simultaneously horrified and delighted to find nobody had done anything on her. So I was like, okay, I'm planting my flag here. This is my new research project.
What's interesting, Amy, is that 400 years later, for someone far more well-known like Catherine of Aragon, I said had the very similar frustrations. Like how can she be so well-known and we know so little about her? And it was, for me, the sources that were the most revealing, where it started actually, was an inventory, which is a printed list of stuff that she owned, and also accounts of the treasurer of the kings of Castile, who was the best bookkeeper on the face of the earth. He is a historian's dream, because he kept all kinds of records. So I can tell you that Catherine of Aragon as a child had 500 yards of silk ribbons that were used for her hair ornaments. That's how I got into material culture. I was so frustrated by not finding stuff, and I can go into long detail about why you can't find things about her, but that's why I turned to material culture, because it revealed. And it was sitting in the British Library, reading an inventory of Catherine's possessions at her death. And in the inventory toward the end, there's a mention of four small counterpanes, four small quilts that were made out of silk. And they were all worn out. And one of them had a little bit of fur on the edging and it was all worn off. And they were her daughter Mary's baby blankets. And they were 20 years old. And she intended to give them to Mary for her own lying in and her own children. And of course, Mary never had children. And I am sitting in the British Library and I am weeping.
Wow.
And I thought, Catherine came alive. She saved them 20 years. And that came out of an inventory, including things like needles and cushions and embroidered stuff and game pieces. That just shook me. And then I thought, what else is out there? And that's when I turned to material culture. But I had to go through all of Henry's stuff to get there. And things that the V&A says he owned, but in fact, wait a minute, no, Henry did not own that thing. That is just not possible. It's just cataloged under his name. But material culture is so rich, and inventories tell you so much about how people lived their lives. The little chairs, the things on the wall, the hair ornaments, all kinds of
stuff. Do you want to talk more about your project on Catherine and tell us about the book that you've written? And you've started sharing that methodology, but can you talk to us more about that?
Sure. This book began with a pair of shoes. Yes. And it really did. It really did. I was looking at the accounts of Gonzalo de Baeza, and I came across something I had never heard of before, which is something called a chopine. And I'm like, what the hell is this? And it turns out it's a very elaborate shoe. It's a platform shoe. And they talk about it as being either 3 fingers high or 5 fingers high. So it's a platform shoe, very common in the Mediterranean. And hers were covered in velvet and silk and all kinds of semi-precious gemstones and tassels and all this. And I'm like, wait a minute. Catherine of Aragon is the dowdy queen that Henry VIII tossed over. She doesn't wear shoes that would make, I don't know, Lady Gaga weep. and I thought, what is this person? So like Amy said, I became an omnivore. I worked with art historians, cultural historians, musicologists, theater people, somebody who studies devotional objects, rosary beads, liturgical garments. I literally hiked all over England in search of Catherine and found her in really unexpected places. So every time I found an object, that object became the focal point of that chapter. So Amy, your comment about how to structure it is so meaningful, because what do you say? How do you say it? Do you follow the chronology of a life? We're historians, so we like things to add up, but do you do that? And so I went to museums. I went to all kinds of places all over England looking for her, and then Spain. I wanted her childhood. So I traveled. I had an itinerary put together by one of the historians that studied Isabel and Fernando. And so I knew where she went as a child. I knew how long she lived in Madrigal. I knew how long she was in Seville. And I could put her in these places. And so I went to those places. I said, okay, so Catherine is here. What did she see? And I looked at altarpieces and I looked at liturgical objects and I looked at space and just said, where was she? Where was this little girl as she was dancing around Spain? She was in Barcelona when Christopher Columbus came back. She was in Granada when the Castilian armies defeated Granada. She was there for the expulsion of the Jews. So I put her in places in Spain. Yeah, my next project is looking at Catherine and the Jews, because I never, ever thought of her like that before. But she was Isabel's daughter. So I want to know more about her relationship with both Jews in Spain and then also when she gets to England.
Yeah.
But each object led me down literally like Alice in Wonderland. I was going down the rabbit hole. And every rabbit hole was filled with the most amazing revelations, because I had long conversations with art historians, people who do textiles. I spent a day at the Victoria and Albert textile workshops, literally looking at those lovely linen and silk embroidered napkins with castles and lions on them, and thinking she touched, this is something that was her. And so that just opened up her world for me. And then you go to conventional stuff like letters to her daughter, and that she was regent in England for the Battle of Flodden, where the English defeated the Scottish king, and her armies actually killed off her brother, her husband's brother-in-law. So it's like all these things came up from that. And so each chapter was organized around a set of objects, painted things, objects that she held, textiles, a rosary bead, an absolutely exquisite boxwood carved rosary that was a gift from Margaret of Austria. And that opened up the relationship with Margaret of Austria. And then everything just went out like an octopus tentacle. And then it was putting it together that was hard. And I had some really superb editors that helped. I think I went through 10 different iterations of organizing the book until I finally settled on one. But it was objects. Objects that did it.
Well, and on the one hand, Amy has worked on Ermengarde, who's historians had never really talked about before. And yet you've taken a figure that I would say all of my students have heard of and have provided us with a story about her life that shows that we actually didn't know very much about her. We know one part of her life, but that's it.
And I think it was the early childhood that is the most fascinating, that I still want to keep returning to. because she lived for 16 years in Castile and I can track where she went. I want to know literally more about that life because so many of her connections later go back to there, the people like Juan Luis Vives mm-hmm. and a lot of the people that were at the court in England that she had contacts with. I want to know more about her letters. And so what I'm on now is a scavenger hunt looking for letters that Catherine wrote to people in Castile that are probably still located in the nobleza, the archives mm-hmm. of the nobility or yeah. somewhere. They're there. They have mm-hmm. to be. I just haven't found them yet, but I'm on that yeah. search.
So as a final question, I wanted to ask you about students interested in this topic of women in power, because I do have a number of students that are working on some well-known women. If students are interested in thinking about topics of women in power in the medieval period, what advice would you give them? Where do they start? And I think we've talked about this a little bit already. What kinds of sources should they look for? But also, what are the questions that they should be asking?
I've thought about it a lot because we all teach. And so yes. students are always looking at stuff like this. And then it's what's accessible to someone in North America. Yes. So it has to be something that's in a language they read. And so it's got to be a good translation of something. Yeah. And as Amy pointed out, it's got to be the whole thing, not just the incipit and the signature lines.
Yeah.
Or not just like one line in the middle that says this castle goes to that person. I find students really, for me, are really responding to expressions of power. So mm-hmm. through things like seals, work, mm-hmm. Signatures work, letters are really helpful because it gives you some sense of connections. When I assign pieces or when I have students work on stuff like this, I have them work on individual relationships rather than big mm-hmm. questions. So yeah. for like example, Catherine and Juan Luis Vives or Ermengarde and one of someone else, right? Just Robert kind of isolate that yeah. and look at that as a sort of small case study rather than trying to tackle the whole of the question. Mm-hmm. Because it's just so huge. And I think we all started out with something really small, like mm-hmm. Amy, yours on inheritance. That was yeah. that is such a crucial piece of information about inheritance laws and how you get power from the land or the possessions that your family owns. And mm-hmm. they seem like really dull documents, but when you open them up, they are not. They are not, yeah. I would say. Mm-hmm.
I never thought that I would ever admit to the fact that reading these loan contracts is actually fascinating because they're the same over and over again. You do learn so much from them, right?
Absolutely.
Because of the social relationships that they reflect, yeah. I think that's part of what it is. It's sort of, and some of your work, Dana, that's so useful is this notion of community, that mm-hmm. women form bonds with people who have similar experiences. And sometimes mm-hmm. it doesn't matter what their religious affiliation is.
Yes. Yeah.
They just literally, yeah. they have affinities. And so those affinity groups can be really powerful. And sometimes it's sisters, sometimes it's cousins, sometimes it's the neighbors. If you can track that through those kind of documents, then it does get away from the kind of formulaic notion of them. And yeah. talks about as a member of a family or as mm-hmm. a member of a community.
And if students are interested in reading charters, there is a wonderful collection of documents edited by Ted Evergates, Feudal mm-hmm. Society in Medieval France, that's been mm-hmm. translated. And I have several in the Beaugency book. There's a whole raft of documents at the end. And I think one of the things that, you know, teaching students, they get frustrated because they expect they're going to go to a source and it's going to be revelatory right. and there's going to be lots of information. Right. It's right. not that, it's the breadcrumb approach. Mm-hmm. You're going to get a little something here, a little something there, and it's going to lead you to something over here. So, you know, don't go into the sources expecting that you're going to find oodles and oodles of information in one place, in one document. It is very much, and sometimes you will. Sometimes there's a motherload of documents. There's a wonderful document from Champagne on female inheritance, for example, and it's fabulous. So sometimes you do hit the motherload, but oftentimes it's following the breadcrumbs, putting together the mosaic as opposed to the whole portrait.
Right.
So you need to have, I think, realistic expectations. I think mm-hmm. Teresa's advice about small bites is good. Coming up with something you can get your arms around, something that you can really delve into is important, as opposed to, I want to talk about the power of women in medieval France. Okay, let's work on that a little bit and say, I want to work on the experience of abbesses mm-hmm. as estate managers in medieval France, or looking at stained glass and looking at images of women or something of mm-hmm. that nature, trying to get something that's bite-sized. And I would also say, I never expected I was going to become a charteraholic. The genre of sources that was really going to warm my heart and take my breath away. So my advice would be for students to read the kinds of sources that they'd like. So yeah, if you're yeah. really into poetry, if you're a legal scholar, read some laws. If you're into mm-hmm. science, read some science stuff. Try to find the sources that play to your interests and your strengths. There's a couple of things. You'll be a little bit more engaged and you'll be excited by what mm-hmm. you find. And you may have a background of information that helps inform your analysis and consideration of that particular topic.
I got great advice when I was in grad school. It's called read around. Yep. So when you read Marie de France, you read her poems, and then you read about the world around her. And mm-hmm. then you formulate questions. Because mm-hmm. to me, it's the questions that they ask. And I always tell my students when they're working on a research project to start out with at least 20 questions. Because the first five are like the who, what, when, where, why. And the next ones are a little bit of how. By the time they get to question 18, 19, and 20, they have a thesis-seeking question. Mm-hmm. And that is crucial. Because my book on Catherine started out with an independent study with a student named Nikki Vedo. Came to me and said, I need a 5-credit independent study. Are you willing to work on? I said, sure. What do you want to work on? She goes, will you work on Queens? Let me do Catherine of Aragon. And I said, great. Give me a book list. Go out, do a bibliographic research, do some historiography. And she came back with 7 books. And I said, wait a minute, this is Catherine of Aragon. Where are the other books? In 2010, I think she started working on this. And I thought, where are we? And so I said, Nikki, let's put together questions. And so out of her question, like, why do we know nothing about Catherine, became a really good historiographic paper, which got me going down the rabbit hole of Catherine. So mm-hmm. ask questions, read something and say, what is going on here? And then keep asking questions. And in that process, you will have a thesis-seeking question. And then all you have to do is figure out how to answer it. And that's not the easy part, but the question is crucial.
But it's the fun part. Yeah,
it is the fun part. Yes. And then I also tell them, don't be dismayed if you don't find out everything you want to know, and know that every project is never finished. Yep. They're always a work in process.
That's a wonderful point for us to end on, I think. So thank you both for a really wonderful discussion. This is absolutely fascinating.
I never turn down anything, any chance for a conversation with you, Dana and Amy. I always say yes. Thank you so much.
I would just say ditto to that. This is just so much fun.